public hearing on House Bill 2070. Teresa, would you like to?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House Bill 2070 comes to you from the Employment Relations Board. It increases filing fees from $100 to $250 to file an answer with the board in regards to unfair practice proceedings under public employee collective bargaining law. It also establishes a fee of $250 for respondents to file charges or an answer with the board. This also creates the Employment Relations Board administrative account to deposit fees and establishes the account to be used for the payment of board incurred expenses. There is an emergency clause, and there's also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, I have three people here. I'm just going to call you all on up here. Donna Sandoval Bennett, Chair of the Employment Relations Board.
Yes,
Jim Green and Mary Butkin. If you all just come on up here. And Donna, if you want to get going.
All right, thank you very much, Chair Schaffler. House Bill 2070 does, it addresses one of the statutory obligations of the Employment Relations Board, which is to hear contested cases that labor and management bring before it in the form of an unfair labor practice complaint as set out in ORS 243-672. At the current time, the party that initiates that unfair labor practice complaint must submit a $250 filing fee, and the responding party files an answer along with a $100 filing fee. The purpose of House Bill 2070 is to equalize the filing fees for both parties in a contested case and amends the relevant statutory language. Labor organizations file the majority of these complaints, which means they pay 2.5 times more than the employers do in their filing fees. Our constituents told us the cost should be spread equally between labor and management. Changing the filing fee to be an equal amount for both parties responds to that request and is more in keeping with the practices of most court systems. If this bill is approved, the additional revenue will be used to fund hearing-related travel expenses and to help fund an additional administrative law judge position if policy package 101 is approved. Having an additional administrative law judge will have a significantly positive impact on the agency's core mission of providing timely resolution to labor disputes. This is reflected in the agency's performance measures, which focuses on how fast cases are heard before the administrative law judges and the board. It's estimated that the increased filing fees will bring in approximately $13,000 per biennium. And while it will aid the Employment Relations Board in funding the additional administrative law judge position, this bill of itself has no staffing impact. Secondly, we are looking at changing some language while preparing the Employment Relations Board's legislative concept to increase the answer filing fee. Legislative Council discovered a discrepancy in the language relating to the board's treasury account. And consequently, new language was drafted to amend ORS 663-185 to establish the Employment Relations Board's administrative account. Legislative Council proposed the new statutory language, which conforms to the standard operating practice of similar agencies. And additionally, it corrects the discrepancy in the statute that currently directs the Employment Relations Board to deposit all funds into the Department of Administrative Services operating fund. The agency funds have not been deposited into that account for a number of biennia, and we need to correct that outdated language. If this bill is not approved, the Employment Relations Board will work with the Department of Administrative Services State Controllers Division to find an interim solution to conform to the statute and prepare a concept for the next legislative session. Thank you.
If there's any burning questions, I'd just soon hear from all three of them, if that's okay with you guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bakken. I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we're one of the larger public employee unions in Oregon, and we use the services that ERB provides extensively. Our concern at this point is not with a fee increase. Our concern is that ERB over the last few biennia has not been funded adequately nor properly in order to perform their core services. And because of that, we'd like to take a look at not just this fee, but a lot of different fees. And what we would like the committee to consider is putting together a work group that would include ERB, ourselves, our management counterparts, and Jim can speak for himself, and a couple of other interested people to sort of look at what ERB's needs are to be properly funded, what their mission is, how much they're short, and come up with a funding plan rather than just sort of stopgap stuff that we've been doing over the years of raising this fee to try and get them an ALJ, raising this fee to get them something. I mean, we just need to take a look at what they're doing well, what they're not doing at all, and what we can do better, and then develop a plan to fund it and bring that back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, and this will be a bit unique that you'll have labor and management coming to the table holding hands talking about a bill together on this one, but I agree with Mary. We do need to take a look at the Employment Relations Board, how it operates, and what services it provides. At no fault of the agency, but due to their cutbacks over the last several biennium, they've not been getting a timely resolution of cases before them. I've heard from several of my folks at the management side that some of the unfair labor practices have been sitting there for quite some time and are waiting for resolution, not because of what Donna and the rest of the ERB members have done, but just their agency has been decimated. They do need another administrative law judge. They need transcription services so we can all get transcripts of what's gone on, a variety of things, and I would concur with Mary that I think a work group would be the proper place to take a look at what the agency needs, come back to you as the policy committee and work with your counterparts in the Ways and Means Committee to fund this agency to ensure what they need to do and the core services they provide in this area are totally funded. I was supposed to have a meeting earlier today with Senator Johnson, who chairs that General Government Subcommittee in Ways and Means, to discuss this. We had to reschedule. I had a quick conversation with her, but she is interested in a work group as well talking about these issues. And it's not anything against the agency. We just need to figure out how to ensure they get their job done and we fund them adequately.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Donna, I have to say I was kind of shocked when I read this bill to learn that it costs $250 to file an unfair labor practice if you're an aggrieved employee. And so
it would not be an aggrieved employee. What this is typically is, Representative Rosenbaum, if I could, it's typically management and labor who come before us. So this would be filed, for example, by a collective bargaining group, for example, like AFSCME or SEIU. They would be the ones that would bring this. This doesn't deal with individuals per se.
So if I were an individual worker and I were trying to form a union and I wasn't yet represented by anybody and I got fired, say, for my activity, and I wanted to come and file a complaint, I assume you were the agency I would come to?
You would.
But I wouldn't have to file that. I wouldn't have to pay that $250 as an individual then?
Yes, you would. But let me tell you that the frequency of that is extremely rare. I would say 99.9% of those cases that come before us are individuals or labor groups or municipalities or the state who come before us as a large employee or employer unit, so to speak. But Jim, do you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, if I may, this dates back to, I believe it was 1997, wasn't it, when we were taking a look at the entire PECBA, the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, and there was massive rewrites going on with it. And this was an attempt, when we raised that fee, to recognize the administrative burden that was put on ERB when one of these was filed there, because they had to open a file, they had to go do some investigation. There was a whole bunch of things that occurred in statute. It was raised, and ERB, I think, originally back in 1997, even wanted a higher fee. And to be honest with you, Mary and I have had discussions. We're willing to take a look at the whole range of fees to see if they're out of line. You know, someone like in your instance where you're saying an individual employee that's not a member of a represented unit yet, maybe we need to alter that for those folks so that they do get their day, quote unquote, in court. And again, ERB and the Unfair Labor Practices and what we do in PECPA covers that. So when we said take a look at the entire gambit of fees, we meant the entire gambit of fees. Do we need to take a look at a lower fee for an individual who's not represented by a union? That's something we could definitely take a look at.
And follow up, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair. So I have to plead ignorance to how you are currently funded, but are these fees pretty much your main source of funding, or what is your budget consist of?
We receive general funds, we receive special funding, we receive assessments. That is primarily our funding base.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Representative Rosenbaum, I think that Mr. Green would agree with me that over the years we've sort of seen a shift from the general fund to fees in order to fund this agency. And we did not oppose the fee increases. I don't believe any of the unions did, and I don't think any of the management folks did, even though we paid the bulk of them because we're usually the filing party. We just felt like ERB services were so critical to resolving labor disputes in a timely manner that the fee that we were going to be paying for filing ULPs was better than not having the services. And, you know, does that mean we're happy about it? Of course not. No more than anybody else is. But the point is that I think we've reached the point now where we really need to take a look at what the agency needs are, how much money do they need to get their job done, and then come up with a funding plan. And it will include fees, but we don't know what else it will include. And I don't think we know that yet, which is why Jim and I sort of talked about it and thought that it made sense to ask the committee to give us a work group to just sort of walk through everything that has happened, everything that may happen, and try and develop a plan with ERB in the room to get their agency properly funded. And we agree that they need transcription services. We agree that we need an ALJ. Maybe we need two ALJs. But we need better services so that the labor disputes that occur are handled quickly and rapidly. The longer they sit out there in the workplace, the worse they get and the tougher they are to settle out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel, I think, was first. I don't know.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these cases do we have a year?
Unfair labor practice cases? We have, we probably have 30 to 40 filed a year. That's a close estimate. At the present time, we... Based on our staffing, we can handle probably 16 of them.
1,300.
Ms. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, we were just handed some data from, I believe, Donna's assistant here. And in fiscal year 06, there were 71 ULPs filed at ERB. Now, some of those may be local, some of those may be state, but we need to get a quick resolution of those. As I think Ms. Bodkin just indicated to you, as the longer they drag on, the worse it is for employment relations in that local entity or at the state level. And some of them have huge policy ramifications, and we need to get that taken care of. During the previous interim, not this last interim, there was a governor's task force on ERB funding. And a lot of the background information with the questions that you're asking are answered in that report. Tom Chamberlain, who was then with the governor's office, chaired that, and both Mary and I served on that. Unfortunately, because of a variety of things, that didn't get before the legislature down into Ways and Means as part of the policy packages for ERB. But I'd be happy to dig that up and provide copies to your administrator so that you on the committee could take a look at least the background of what we all took a look at. And it was a split of management and labor that tried to come together on that. Really, the main thrust of that report, real quickly, if I could, Mr. Chair, was to say, look, you've created the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. You, the legislature, you, the state, have created this. And the rules under which both management and labor play were created by you, and you want us to settle these things out as much as we can locally, but we believe that it should have been a state-funded agency. Because of what has gone on with our state budget since we had the fall back in 2000-2001, not only was ERB cut, you know, all the rest of state government was cut, and we've tried to build it back at some level. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to build this agency back quickly enough with the backlog of cases they have. I will make a copy of that. It's on the web, but I'll make sure your committee administrator gets a copy of that so that you folks can take a look at kind of the caseload that ERB has had to deal with and where we were before this session and what we did in the interim. I'm not saying that report and the suggestions are what we're going to come up with, but it's good background information for you to have.
Let me also say, too, that we have about as Mr. Green mentioned, 71 ULPs filed. The ALJs do make a concerted effort to settle a lot of those cases. And so when I mentioned earlier that we have approximately 40 that actually go to hearing, that's probably more accurate.
Representative Berger?
Yeah, not to belabor this, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I was interested in Mr. Green's comment that there was an interim committee, because it sounds like, you know, we're on a pretty short timeline, and if we need a full, you know, work group to start from scratch, I was going to suggest interim. But if there's already been a lot of base work done, and if you have a notion then that this is work that we could get done during the, you know, I was going to say it should be interim, but it sounds like a lot of the interim work has been done, and you could move straight forward to some pretty substantive suggestions, then I think that's fine.
Ms. Chairman, Representative Berger, that is Ms. Bodkin and I's commitment to this committee, is we want to come back with you something that both labor and management can agree to and bring it back to the table. I've spoken with my compatriots of the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties on this idea, and they were all in agreement that we could probably get that done and get it done in a short order, because I think what you want from us is agreement from us working with the agency to come back with you for recommendations, and we will do that.
And I have done the same with my labor counterparts of saying, you know, here's what we're going to do. If you have a problem, now's the time to say it. And everybody's pretty comfortable with Jim and I working through a process, and then we'll take it back to our compatriots and have them look it over before, so that there's no surprises when we get here. Because this does need to move, and it needs to move quickly. And I want to say that we all appreciate the work that ERB does. And one of the things you don't see in Oregon a lot is you don't see a lot of uncontrolled strike activity. And part of that's because ERB does do a good job. And, you know, we took out almost 1,200 people statewide at the Department of Corrections 4 years ago, and it barely got on the 5 o'clock news because we managed our strike well. ERB helped. We were in mediation, and the strike only lasted a week, and we reached a mediated settlement. And ERB provided those services, and those are critical services for us. And you know, you don't want the Department of Corrections folks out on the picket line for very long.
He's pending inside.
Representative Bowlby?
This would be the non-security staff that was on strike.
Representative Bowlby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the work that ERB does as well. I think maybe some of the initial confusion in first looking at this bill is, you know, the word unfair labor practice in the private sector, you know, makes me think of a different organization at the federal level and not really public sector workers here in Oregon, you know, and dealing with your specific law around public sector workers and collective bargaining. And so you have a different fee schedule or a way to pay for those services than the National Labor Relations Board does, for example. My question is really, because I noticed you mentioned that you do administer statutory schemes where private sector labor management relation law is involved, and I'm trying to figure out when that would be a case, when you would actually deal with private sector issues in regards to unfair labor practices.
Oddly enough, it's very rare, and what happens, but when we see it, is
I would think it would never happen.
It happens very rarely, and there are some employers out there who, as part of their collective bargaining agreements, will give their employees redress to the Employment Relations Board, State of Oregon, rather than the NLRB. The reason for that is while we do suffer from a bit of slowness right now because of our staffing issues, it takes 2 to 3 years to get something through the NLRB. And employers, so there are some public employer, private employers who just don't want to let it draw out that long. As Mary said, you know, labor disputes, it's, they work best when they're resolved as quickly as possible and as collegially as possible.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, these are folks who are not covered by the NLRB. They kind of almost fit under it, but they don't. So our collective bargaining law on the state or herbs funding allows those folks to come in. And that was one of the things we addressed in that task force, was to say in those instances, you know, those private entities ought to pay the full boat for the going cost at herb, which was one of the issues we brought up. But these are folks who almost fit under the NLRB, but don't quite. And so they have to go to herb. There's, I think last time the former chair, Paul Gamson, said they saw one or two cases every 2 or 3 years.
That's true.
Well, let me give you an example of a group. We just organized 4,000, a little over 4,000 child care providers that are licensed and certified through the state of Oregon, and they actually bargain with DHS. And so we're acting as their collective bargaining agent, even though they're sort of private sector, but not really. They don't fit either place very well, And so what we're doing is we're handling them through I think it's going to be through the miscellaneous section of the law, but their redress will be through ERB. And so we will want to be able to access ERB in a quickly and timely manner.
That's good. Well, good. So get this work group together. Would you please let everyone on the committee know when your meetings are, and if anybody's interested, as long as a quorum of us don't show up. I may show up now after this conversation. And I just want to say I do share Representative Rosenbaum's concern about the individual out there. And I don't even think a lot of those folks may not even know who to turn to. So, and I know it's probably not the board's job to say, go call the AFL-CIO or ask me or somebody, but I do share that concern. And I do want to take, I don't want someone out there, some worker who feels their rights have been denied, to have to come up with $250. I just don't, because if they already have been wronged, now we're going to ask them for $250. And I think if they do prevail, I have to be careful with this one because of another bill that's before us, I think maybe they should be refunded their whatever their fee is. That's just something to think about. But so go ahead and put a nice group of people together and come back and make everybody happy, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much.
Can you let us know, Mr. Chair, who on your committee?
I'm not assigning anybody specifically. Representative Esquivel's expressed concern. I think I'm going to show up. Make sure we all know when it is.
Work through your committee administrator, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, that'd be fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. All right, we're going to close, unless there's anything else on that one, we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2070. And the next three I'm just going to hear all at the same time and then call folks up because there aren't that many folks signed up. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2168, House Bill 2169, and House Bill 2170. And I would like to have Patrick Allen, Daniel McNeil, and Steve Farrow come forward. And there's one person signed up for 2170, Mr. Nelson. We won't forget you. Mr. Allen, do you want to just go ahead and you're just signed up for 2168. You want to go ahead and give us your...
Yeah, just very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. We've got some individual time scheduled later with Representative Edwards, but I've worked with most of you over the past sessions on regulatory streamlining, and so in the interest of everybody's July vacation plans, I'm not planning on doing a big regulatory streamlining dog and pony show for the committee. I did, however, quickly, as with the co-requester on these three bills, just want to give you a very quick wind-up. I believe these are the first of our regulatory streamlining legislative package that you're getting as a committee. Last session, you may recall, we introduced over 30 bills collectively as state agencies to streamline regulations, and almost all of those passed. We've got 31 of those bills, most of them introduced in the House, and a large chunk of them coming to this committee from about a dozen agencies. And in one way or another, they all represent areas where state agencies, with some legislative changes, can make business regulations cheaper, faster, simpler, easier to comply with, easier to understand, without reducing standards for protecting consumers, workers, public health, safety, the environment, and those kinds of things. And they really run a wide gamut of kinds of changes. Many of them, small fiddles or those kinds of things, they fit in a context of over 350 different efforts that agencies are making without legislative changes that accomplish the same thing to streamline those regulations. So I just wanted to offer that brief bit of context for these three bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, Mr. McNeil, please.
Yeah, I'll lead off. For the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the Liquor Commission, and I'm here with Dan McNeil. He is the Metro Licensing Manager for the Commission, and he will provide the testimony with regards to these three bills.
Great, and I'll lead off.
I'm just going through down how you signed up, so
okay.
I understand. I'm in pecking order here, but go ahead.
Yes, I've been introduced, but for the record, my name's Dan McNeil, and I am the Metro Licensing Unit Manager for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. We're here today to support these bills, and I'll start out with 2168.
Yes, sir. And if you guys have any burning questions, if the members have any burning questions as we hear these, just go ahead and wave, and we'll get. Otherwise, we'll just go right through them and then wait for them as you wish.
Great.
Go ahead, sir.
2168 was submitted by OLCC, and this deals with temporary sales licenses issued by OLCC. Just for a little background for the committee members, a temporary sales license is a license issued by OLCC that allows somebody to sell alcohol at a premises that's usually not licensed by us, and usually for a short-term temporary event. A good example of these you might be familiar with would be like a spaghetti dinner at a local church. They want to sell alcohol and raise money. It could be a dance, a concert, a show put on by somebody that's going to run for a short period of time, or even an event as big as like the Portland Downtown Waterfront Park events, like the Blues Festival that happens every year. So those are kind of the range of events that we have. This bill really is meant to accomplish two things with the temporary sales licenses. First, three things. First is it makes the fee a uniform fee for the license. It makes it easier to calculate. Currently, the law says that the fee for a temporary sales license is $25 for each 5 hour or portion of 5 hours for an event. And so that means that if a person is having an event that lasts longer than 5 hours, then their next $5 increment, and then if they're longer than 10 hours, they're another $25 increment for that fee. That fee gets a little bit complicated to calculate for a lot of our people holding special events, especially events that go over a number of days and they're running a little over 5 hours each day or longer each day. And that leads to problems with people that want to come in and pay for this. And these, a lot of times, are small groups. They send somebody in to apply at the last minute to get the license. And having the wrong fee can create problems for those people. So this just sets a standard $50 fee per day for the event. That's very easy to calculate for people that are applying for the license. It also means that there won't be an increase in fees for the average licensee. We did some look back at the licenses that we issued last year, calculated averages, and on average the events that we license last about 8.5 hours. So people are really paying $25 twice, the $50 for those events. They'd still be paying $50 for those events if this bill's passed. The second thing that this bill does has to do with who's eligible for this temporary sales license. Currently, certain groups are eligible for licenses for all types of events, but the people that are eligible for all types of events are people that have a nonprofit or charitable status, and they can hold an event, or if they're a local government subdivision, they can have an event where they have a beer garden, or they may have an event that's restricted to age 21 and older. Anybody else that applies for a license has to have an event which has minors, which is appropriate for minors throughout the event. And that means that you've got an event where you've got minors and alcohol mixed at all times the events are going on. Now, a lot of the people that are putting on these events want to do things more responsibly. They say, well, I would like to have this event. My ideal for controlling this event is that I'd either have a beer garden, there's alcohol here, and that's where the alcohol is, and that's where the adults can go, and then the rest of the event I'd like to have no alcohol. Under our rules, we have to tell those people, I'm sorry, you can't do that event. And so they've got one of two choices. They can change the event and make an event where you have walk-around alcohol, alcohol and minors mixed, or they can try and find one of our annual licensees to extend their license to the event. And what we found is the majority of people faced with that situation choose to make the event a walk-around event. And that is kind of disconcerting for us as an agency, that we tell people that, yeah, we understand you'll have better alcohol control under this system where you have a beer garden or maybe no one at the event under 21, but you just can't do it that way. You've got to have this all-ages event. So this change to the statute would really fix that and allow us to issue licenses to those people that want to be responsible. The other thing that we have with this bill is it fixes a minor problem between two statutes. Right now, this temporary sales license says that under the privileges of a temporary sales license that you can auction off alcohol. There's another statute on the books, which is ORS 471-408, that states that only a charitable, nonprofit organization may sell wine and only wine by raffle. So on the one hand, this privilege says you can do this. There's another statute that says you can't. That creates a little bit of a problem when we're trying to explain to people why they really have to be a charitable nonprofit group and they can only auction wine when it appears to grant them that privilege in this bill. So this changes that. It removes the provision from the temporary sales license. But while we're doing that, we still preserve the right of the charitable nonprofit groups to raffle off wine, and they can do that without a license if this change is made. And that's all I have on this bill. Are there any questions?
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably an obvious answer for you, but I was just sort of curious about the $50 per day charge. Now, is the day defined as 24 hours starting at noon and ending at noon the next day, or is it midnight to midnight, or do I have the latitude to pick my own time frame of 24 hours, or is it a calendar day?
Actually, a little different, Chairman and Representative Holby. The day that we're talking about is the day that's under statute for legal alcohol sales, and those hours run from 7 a.m. to 2:30 a.m. that same evening. So even though technically it goes between 2 days, it's actually that period of time we're talking about. 7 a.m. to 2:30 a.m. And those are the legal hours for alcohol sale in Oregon.
Okay, that clears it up for me. Thanks.
Any other questions? I guess you're doing a great job. Just go to the next one.
I'll move on to the next bill. The next bill is House Bill 2169. This bill is also submitted by OLCC. The purpose of this bill is to streamline OLCC's application process and position the agency to move to an internet-based license application for initial licenses. Now, our agency is currently implementing a new license system, and this system will give us the capability in the future to accept applications over the Internet for initial licenses. And this bill really provides a vehicle to implement that and to provide our applicants with a level of service and convenience that they've come to expect from the Internet, and that's that I can apply online and pay the fee at the same time. Now, the current law, without this amendment, means that people can't pay their bill, pay for their license at the time they apply, and that's because the license fee is really based on two factors currently. The first year, the law says we have to give a proration on that license application fee, and that proration is based on a fee that's established by both the geographic area, part of the state that the person lives in, and the date that the license is issued. Because these things, we don't know what date we're going to issue a license at the time we accept the application, we can't tell somebody what the fee is, and they can't send in the fee at the time they apply. Now, that can be difficult for licensees and a little bit frustrating. They get online, they pull up an application, they submit the application, and there's no mechanism for them to pay the bill. What it also means is that they have to wait until the agency calls them up and says, we're now ready to issue your license. We've completed all the steps in the investigation process. We're now ready to issue the license, and here's the fee, and you've got to, before you can start exercising that license, you need to pay us that fee. And what that leads to today is people having to stop in the middle of their work day. They may be running their business without alcohol sales. They'll shut the business down, drive to our office, pay the fee to get the authority and then drive back to the office, or depending on the work day that they're doing, they may not be able to do it that day. They may be, you know, stuck waiting a couple of days before selling alcohol. So that's the purpose behind this bill. We do realize that this will raise what some licensees are paying under the prorated fees. Some licensees pay for the full license year at the time they get their license. Some pay a quarter of that or a third of that or half of that fee. Now everybody will pay the same fee for the first year of licensing, no matter how long the license period is. I'm happy to take any questions that we have.
Representative Berger?
If this passes, Mr. McNeil, you probably won't have a lot of license applications that come in December. Is that the idea?
Actually, the license year is actually broken out into four periods. Some of our licenses run January to December 31st. Some of our licenses, the licensure begins April 1st, some July 1st, and some October 1st. So it depends on where you are in the state to do that. The reason why we have these staggered renewal times is because it essentially evens out the workload for our staff. We don't have to deal with every single license application in a two-week window. And also, geographically, all the licenses expire at the same time in the same area. And that means that the distillery reps and the people that are going and delivering alcohol know that, oh, today's the day licenses expire in this area, I need to check with these people before I make a delivery, and it keeps them out of trouble. So, and what we found is what really drives people's decisions on a license. Our license fees are very reasonable. Our fee for a off-premises license, which would be a grocery store, convenience store, is $100 a year. The fee for a tavern is $200 a year. A fee for a place that is selling distilled spirits by the drink is $400 a year. So these fees are not high, and they really don't drive people's decision on getting into business. We find people will say, hey, I just want to get into business, because the important thing for them is getting that business started, getting the business, the customers in the door.
So it's just the first year that they're going in, so after that it really doesn't make a difference.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, well, let's keep moving on here.
Just one question, just to follow up on Representative Berger's comments. So this stagger that you have is strictly for geographic areas, but doesn't really help me as a customer who wants to get, if my particular area is January 1st and I come in November, I'm going to be in a situation that Representative Berger was alluding to, that I'm not going to get a lot of months covered for that 1 year. It's not that I have the choice to be on an October to October year or a January.
That's correct, Chairman. Representative Holvey, that is correct. That it's really based on the area where you're located, not when you're applying for your license.
Thank you.
All right. Very good.
Okay. Well, the final bill I'm going to talk about is House Bill 2170. And this is a bill also that has been submitted by OLCC. This bill ultimately supports economic development by making our licensing process more efficient for liquor license applicants while maintaining our ability to address public safety issues. Now, the concept for this bill came from a consensus recommendation from the OLCC Joint Task Force on Saturation and Problem Areas. That was a task force formed by OLCC that the governor charged with making statutory recommendations relating to liquor licenses. Now, this task force was comprised of an equal balance of business interests and representative from local governments and neighborhoods. Now, this bill proposes two amendments to the current laws. One, it would allow all license applicants to apply for a temporary authority to operate, and secondly, it increases the period of time that those temporary authorities are valid from 90 to 180 days. Now, the temporary authority I'm talking about, for a little background, is actually an authority issued by OLCC to people who apply for a liquor license. And what that authority does is allows the person who's applying to operate their business while we're investigating their license application. Now, currently, that license authority, that temporary authority, is limited to two classes of people that are applying for a license. The first one is if you're opening a new business that's, say, a grocery store or a convenience store and selling alcohol to go, you can apply and receive that temporary authority. The other class of people that can get those are people that are buying an existing business. So if you're buying Joe's Bar and it's already got a liquor license, you can get that temporary authority to operate. The temporary authority isn't available for about half of our license applicants, and those are people that are doing one of three things. they're either opening up brand new business. It can be a tavern, a bar, a winery, a wholesale business. So they're opening up a brand new business. It doesn't apply to people who are adding a privilege to their license. So if I've got a tavern and or a bar and I want to sell wine to go, I've decided to sell fine wine to go, I can't do that until I've gotten the license approved by OLCC. And the final group is people who are actually changing the location of their business. So you may be moving your business from here. You may be moving two blocks, two miles, or two cities away, and we can't give you a temporary authority that allows you to operate your business while we process the application. Now, the application process currently averages between 3 and 4 months. So that's a considerable delay for people trying to get into business and a time in which they can't operate. So the purpose of this bill is to extend those 90-day authorities to people who are in that situation and applying for a liquor license, would allow them to operate. Now, what we look at is about 90% of the people that apply for a license are going to be issued a license. And extending this authority will help them get into business faster and, again, ultimately supports Oregon's economy. Now, there's some potential downsides to this proposal. Now, applicants who get a temporary authority, which is not a license, it's an authority to operate, but it's technically not a license, are not guaranteed that they're going to get a license because we issue that authority. And having a license refused can be costly to a person who's expended time and money to get into business and open their business. And we also know that a bad business operator can have a negative impact on neighbors and local police resources. So there's some downsides. Now, we minimize these risks and try to manage these risks to applicants and communities by completing criminal history checks before we do that temporary authority. So we actually run a background check on the person, make sure that they don't have any crimes or convictions that would preclude them from being licensed. If they're a current licensee, we take a look at their compliance record, make sure that they're a good operator and they have a good record of compliance. And finally, we have applicants complete a law orientation, so they're familiar with liquor laws before they begin to operate their business, so that they know what's expected of them as a business operator. So those are the things that we do on the front end. Now, with this passes, it will be a change, because you'll have new businesses getting these temporary authorities, and that will require closer cooperation and communication between local governments, police, OLCC, and citizen groups to make sure that we react quickly if there are problems. But again, we expect minimal problems with businesses. Finally, on this bill that we're looking at is that the temporary authority can act as a provisional license. What it means is that by giving somebody authority that doesn't currently have one, we actually get a chance to look at their business in operation before we issue the permanent license. And that's a big benefit that we don't have now. Right now, we have to rely on what people tell us about their operation, and we look at their background, and we try to make educated decisions about how they operate. This actually gives us a chance to see that business in operation. It gives the local government a chance to see that business in operation, and it gives the local community, neighbors, a chance to see the business in operation before we actually issue the annual license to the person. And we feel that's a big benefit from this bill, and it will provide us a chance to look at that and also to work with licensees to correct their operation and make changes to improve things if they start out on a rocky start before they get an annual license. The other thing that this bill proposes to do is to increase the time period for those temporary authorities. Currently, those authorities are issued for a 90-day period. We're asking to extend that time period to 180 days. That gives us a longer time. We'll be dealing with more applicants working under these authorities, and also gives us a longer period of time when we can work with them and they can operate while we investigate the license application. And we believe that that's a benefit also. In closing, we believe that this bill will support economic development by helping our license applicants get into business faster and will provide a means to better assess the licensed business before we issue an annual license. I thank you for your time and would welcome any questions that you have.
I only have one question. If they're squared away under 180 days, they get it before that time limit?
They can. This doesn't mean that we have to hold out their license for 180 days. It just gives us the opportunity.
Good. Any other questions of the agency representative? Smith, I'm glad you're feeling better. I hope you're feeling better.
I am.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question. Was there anybody on the joint task force opposed to this bill? And what were their objections?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I have no knowledge that anyone opposed it.
Okay.
it was a consensus recommendation, but I do not know of particular ones that might have opposed the bill.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you. Oh, Representative Holby.
Just while I'm talking way too much, probably, for your liking and mine, but thank you for your indulgence. I just wanted to, I haven't had a chance to look at this. I can probably answer my own question, but maybe you could, and maybe you've already spoke to this, but I was just curious what part of this bill is considered when you're repealing 471-302 in this. I noticed you're repealing that section, and I didn't hear you mention that. What does that repeal?
Okay.
And I know Representative Berger is going to answer my question here pretty quick, you know.
Unfortunately, I've only got the draft language here, so.
I have the same question.
Well, I was going to get up and look it up, but I thought you probably knew.
I should know. Do we have to call legislative counsel up here?
Well, we can.
Would you like a copy of the bill?
I've got a copy of the bill. Okay. I don't have a copy of the original law, though.
Sorry to have
that's all right.
302.
Okay.
471.
Well, I'm sure we can get that answered later, too.
471.
Well, now that you brought it up,
sorry.
We're going to find out. And if it's not more than a page, just read it for us, Representative.
Okay, 471.
Not more than two sentences.
302.
301, 302,
yes. I'm not fast at this, you guys.
You're doing great. You were faster than the rest of us.
Well, I had the same question. 371-402.
372.
302.
I'm in
402.
Okay.
Am I getting close, Representative?
We're getting there.
302, temporary letter of authority for off-premises sales license applicant revocation. It's a paragraph. I'm not going to read it all.
And now that you've said that, that's what it is that now that all license applicants will be eligible for this temporary authority, right now there's two different statutes that set out the temporary authority, one for people buying a new business, one for those off-premises sales licenses. That part on off-premises sales license isn't needed anymore because we're changing the authority to issue it to all license applicants. So
there you go. Thank you.
All right, any other questions of the agency? Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that gave me time to think of another question. So it doesn't appear that the notice to neighborhoods or people who might care to testify would be affected by this, but I'm not familiar with what that process is for temporary licenses.
The process.
Is there notice given?
Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, we do give notice, and we do two things for notice. Currently, we post a public notice, which is kind of a bright neon green sign that goes at the location of the business that's applying for a liquor license, if they're applying for a new license. And then secondly, we give a notice to neighborhood associations, and that's written notice to the neighborhood association saying a person has applied for a license, describing the license they've applied to, and how to give us information on that application.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. Ma'am. Is that process the same then for a temporary license as for a permanent one?
The temporary, Chairman and Representative Rosenbaum, the process right now is the same for a license application, whether or not the person asks for a temporary license or not. So those cases where we do issue a temporary license, we do that same notice for new businesses and to neighborhood associations. So the process would be the same. And it's not specific to that temporary sales license. It's a chance to comment on the liquor license application itself.
Thank you.
All righty then. Well, thank you very much. And as I call Mr. Nelson up here, There's a bunch of nice people in the crowd. If any of you are compelled to testify, now's your chance. So you guys can go have a seat.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Uh,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I'm appearing today on behalf of Bill Perry, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'll be very brief. I think the OLCC has outlined what issues are involved in this bill. We support the bill, the Oregon Restaurant Association, as well as 7-Eleven, which I represent, participated in this task force. And I'm trying to, I didn't myself participate, but I'm trying to remember if there was any dissenting votes on this. I think you could only have, out of the entire task force, you had to have everyone but two or three to have a consensus, to be able to call it a consensus. I think there were like 12 or 14 people, and neighborhoods and local governments were represented on the task force. But as has been explained, if you are selling your particular business, have a change of ownership, you can get a temporary license. Our primary interest on the Oregon Restaurant Association side is when you're applying for a new license and it's a new ownership, and this would extend that right for a temporary license while it's being processed to that particular licensee. And has been indicated on the 7-Eleven side, we already have that right now to have a temporary license, so it's taken care of on that side, but not on the restaurant side. And again, as has been indicated, it takes the number of days from 90 to 180 days. So again, the industry is very supportive of this effort and applaud the OLCC and the task force for bringing this to you and reaching an agreement on it. It will move businesses forward quickly, more quickly.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Nelson today? All righty then.
Thank you,
sir. My pleasure. Unless there's anything else on these bills, I'm going to close the hearings on House Bill 2168, 2169, and 2170. Are there anything for the good of the order here today? Any comments, questions? I think we're all ready to go then. I will close the committee. It's adjourned. Thank you.